It's the 20th of May 2011, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions: if all rap were about evolution, would the Beastie Boys be some sort of missing link? Is asking a religious organisation not to proselytise a bit like asking a cat not to lick its own genitals? If you go for a lovely relaxing walk in the country and happen to be alongside the wall separating the Israelis from the Palestinians, what country are you in? Is the Hargreaves Report copyright or copy wrong? Can Christians and skeptics work together for a common cause? Or do Christians believe that causes were created by God 6,000 years ago and that there's no such thing as a common cause? And how did Cash end up trapped on a boat with a bunch of crackpots? But first, if the rapture takes place tomorrow, will Jesus appear as a guest on next week's Pod Delusion? As you may have heard in the media this week, we could be on the verge of the rapture. A Christian radio group in America have predicted that the rapture will happen tomorrow, May the 21st. So if all goes according to plan, on Sunday morning all of the loyal British Christians will have disappeared and the churches around the UK will be empty. So a bit like a normal Sunday morning, basically. You may have guessed that I'm a bit cynical about this. After all, predictions like this have been made before and turned out to be false. But I'm going to play this one safe. So Jesus, if you're back on Earth and listening, tell your PR people to get in touch with us, as we'd love to interview you. Presumably you have a New Testament to plug, what with tomorrow's events. To find out more about the prediction, Salim Fadley has been speaking to a member of the group predicting the rapture.
This is probably the last episode of the Pod Delusion that I will ever contribute to. No, I've not had artistic differences with James, our editor. It's just that I'm going to die. Let me explain. I'm not sick or suicidal. It's just that May the 21st, 2011, is the day that the world ends. And chances are, if you're listening to this show right now, you too may die. According to the prophecies made by Harold Camping, the founder of Family Radio and the E-Bible Fellowship, both are Christian organizations based in the city of Philadelphia, May 21st, 2011 is the day when it all ends. I spoke with Chris McCann, who is a teacher and researcher in the E-Bible Fellowship. I asked him if he really believes that the Christian God is about to destroy the entire universe.
I believe that 100% with all my heart.
And how are you preparing for Judgment Day?
It's like when an individual who has been sick goes to the doctor, and then the doctor gives him a date when he'll perish. And it takes a little bit of time to get adjusted to that, and as you get closer and closer, the impact of that knowledge that your life will be over, it begins to hit you stronger. And the impact is one of wanting to live our life as Christ always wanted his people to live. As he said, take up your cross and follow me.
Can you start actually by explaining what Judgment Day is? There are some words that non-Christians will be unfamiliar with, such as the rapture, Judgment Day itself.
The rapture is a theological term. It's not found in the Bible. The Bible uses much simpler language. It just says taken up is basically what the rapture means. And then there's the resurrection and the rapture. And they basically mean the same thing. The only difference is the resurrection applies to the dead, and the rapture applies to the living. If someone was someone that God saved in their lifetime and then they died at whatever point in history, it doesn't matter when, then on May 21, that's the day that God's going to and join it with their soul, which has been in heaven since that point of death. It's the fulfillment of everything the Bible has indicated.
What about people such as myself who are not Christian? What can we expect to happen to us?
On May 21, when the earthquake comes, when that happens, many living, unsaved people will die. And
would it be fair to summarize it as literally hell on earth?
Yes. Hell, actually, as the Bible teaches it, is the grave. And there is no place that God will create. But we've learned that May 21 is Judgment Day. And yes, there is punishment. and any individuals who do not die in the earthquake and forever, however long they live, into that five-month period will be experiencing extreme torment.
Other than repentance, is there any hope for all of us? For example, do you think we could ask God to delay judgment just a little bit, or perhaps cancel it altogether?
No, there's no possibility of that. No, okay. There is no possibility that even if the whole world repented, it's God's plan to destroy this world at some time. The Bible's always been very clear about that.
The reasoning behind the belief that the 21st of May is Judgment Day seems to be highly complex. Even if you might say God is infallible, isn't there just the tiniest possibility the scholars who discovered this Judgment Day code in the Bible might have misunderstood the text? Would it be plausible to assume that fallible human minds might not be able to perfectly interpret a text of this complexity and age?
There is zero possibility that we are incorrect about May 21. It is God guaranteed, or the Bible is the one itself that is guaranteeing this.
You speak of certainty and rock-solid guarantees, which to a non-religious person like myself sounds immediately strange. Isn't there even the tiniest bit of doubt? There's almost no aspect of human endeavor that we could say that we have accomplished perfection. Isn't there any room for possibility of misunderstanding?
No, I'm sorry. That's a very common thought that people have. They just want the child of God to admit, or just, if this by chance doesn't happen, what will you do on May 22nd? No, that's not possible. God has locked it in. He's the one who has confirmed the date.
I understand you've been doing a great many radio interviews, and the one question that everyone, including myself, is desperate to ask is, well, if it all goes wrong on May the 21st, would you be willing to come back and talk to us on May the 22nd?
It's not a question that I would entertain. It would be like someone saying to me, now, if the Bible isn't the Word of God, I know the Bible is the Word of God. And I would encourage you and everyone, not to take my word, I know you won't, but to check it out. There is information that lays out a history of the world from creation and hits key point of biblical importance all the way to the very end. And then we see how the numbers fall together. Numbers don't lie.
Or do they? My conversation with Chris had to be edited down from about half an hour, in which he explained in great detail the calendrical and numerological reasons behind his certainty that Judgment Day will occur on May the 21st of this year. His reasons are complex and depend on cherry-picking a disjointed selection of Bible passages. I'm no theologian, but even I can suspect that this is a very unorthodox kind of Bible study. Fortunately, the Pod Delusion is aware of somebody perfectly qualified to dissect this latest end times prediction. John Wallace is a senior lecturer in criminology and social policy at Liverpool Hope University. He has made an extensive study of apocalyptic and millennial religious groups and rapture cultures. He's also written on the use of apocalyptic imagery and texts in our popular culture more widely. I began by asking John if what's going on in Philadelphia right now is unusual amongst rapture groups. The founder discovers what he believes to be a clue to the end times, hidden in plain sight in the text of the Bible. Is this how end times predictions begin?
The classic example of this would be William Miller in the 19th century in America, who spent several decades studying the Bible and came up with what he said was going to be the date of the end of the world. Nothing happened, so he went back and recalculated it, came up with another date, and that wasn't the date either. So there are different ways of doing it, but there is definitely a tradition that goes back millennia at least, where you take the Bible, you take the the numbers, or you always read it like a code. So you take like the Book of Daniel or the Book of Revelation, which are both very metaphorical texts, and you read symbols out of them into as numbers, or as world leaders, or as geopolitical events or geopolitical figures.
The tradition very much involves people reading these ancient texts as if the symbols were referring to contemporary events.
Over the last 2,000 years, a variety of prophets have taken, for example, the Book of Revelation, which is quite metaphorical, quite symbolic, and taken aspects of that and interpreted contemporary geopolitical events through it. So, for example, in the Middle Ages, the idea of the Antichrist was thrown around by both the Protestant reformers and the Catholics as a way of kind of framing the other as negative. So you can very much look at the themes and the imagery in these texts as adaptable to different, because they are almost empty vessels that can be flooded with meaning to reflect whatever particular concerns or issues are vexing people at a particular moment.
Apocalyptic predictions are just about the only testable claims that religions make, but these are all tests which have hitherto failed. So yeah, how do groups generally react when the prophecies they've invested so much energy and emotion into eventually fail?
Well, you would think that you would make a specific claim like Jesus will reappear tomorrow and then nothing happens. You would go back and rethink the belief. But the whole literature that we have in the social sciences from the 1950s shows that what groups do is find ways of adapting. So they'll, for example, the common strategy is what's called spiritualization, which is where you say, well, what we've said was going to happen has happened, but it's happened in a spiritual rather than a literal sense. So when we say that Jesus will reappear, he has reappeared, but it reappeared in a spiritual sense in our lives, not in a literal, physically coming down to earth way. There's that, all groups might say, well, a leader might say, well, I knew all along it was going to happen, I was just testing you. Or another strategy is to say, well, it was going to happen, but the reason why it didn't happen is because you weren't ready. You said to the followers, you weren't ready, and you've kind of held up the cosmic timetable. But generally, it's looked at in a spiritual sense. William Miller, in the 19th century, when his second prophecy failed, there was what was called the Great Disappointment. Members left. But then a group of members who later became the Seventh-day Adventists said, well, actually, no, what hasn't happened is Jesus never left heaven. But what he did is he took a step from the inner sanctum of heaven to the outer kind of limits of heaven. He's taken the first stage, but not the second stage in appearing to us.
What about from the perspective of the individual? How does being so closely associated or even involved with a failed prophecy usually affect the individual believers within these groups?
Well, this is where the theory that we often use in social sciences is what's called cognitive dissonance, which is where you have two ideas that don't gel together. For example, you might say, well, I know smoking is bad for me, but I do it. So it's how do you kind of gel those two things? And what we find in the social science literature is that people try and find ways of explaining what happens. So the theory of cognitive dissonance would say that what people do, they look at these explanations by saying, well, it's happened in a spiritual sense, or it was a test. So very, very rarely do people say, well, the prophecy has failed, therefore I should reject the belief and go into something else. People, particularly when they have a lot invested in a group or a lot invested in the belief system, will find ways of rationalising it.
The 21st of May group appears to have been a splinter from more mainstream American Christian groups. What happens when one of these groups tends to fragment from the mainstream?
Well, it's a huge cycle that in the 19th century and early 20th century, the German social theorist Max Weber came with this idea that what you have within religion is you have religion, a particular religion may become staid, but it may become conservative, and then a radical group will break away and say you've become staid, you've become kind of boring, we want to kind of return to the core of the tradition. And they're radical. But then over time, as the group ages, as in the institutions grow, they too become staid and conservative, and then another group will from within that will break away. So within the sociology of religion, we have this idea that radical groups will break away from staid groups, and over time they'll become staid, and it's almost like a constant cycle of staidness going into radicalization and so on.
The May 21st believers will be the latest in a very long line of religious groups whose apocalyptic predictions will be proved wrong. History is full of these kinds of stories. So why do religious groups have such difficulty in recognizing their own delusions?
If I could answer that, I'd have a chair in religious studies somewhere. I struggle with this myself. But I guess that the thing with the groups themselves is fundamentally they don't recognize the failed prophecy, whereas we as outsiders will look at the prophecy and say, well, you must accept that the prophecy has failed. They don't do it. I mean the classic story from anthropology is an anthropologist saw a witch doctor, and the witch doctor said, well, I can predict the future by cutting open a chicken and looking at its entrails. And whereas we would say, well, if that's the case, you should be able to, as in science, you should be able to repeat it. You should be able to cut open a chicken twice and get the entrails to flop out in the same way. What the witch doctor did was do it to the first one, and then when he did it to the second one, the entrails flopped out in a completely different way. And rather than being stumped, the witch doctor said, well, I can explain this. What must have happened is another witch doctor must have cursed the second chicken. It's exactly like this with these types of groups. What they will do is, particularly when they have a lot invested in belief, they'll find a way of rationalizing it. And these groups that we're talking about are very high investment groups. It costs a lot emotionally, psychologically, and often financially to be a member. Therefore, there's an incentive to make sense of what's going on, try and make sense of why the prophecy hasn't happened as they initially thought it would happen.
As bonkers as it may sound, I'm all for religious groups predicting the end times. It's a very rare case of a religious group actually publishing empirically testable claims about their beliefs. So, wishing you an earthquake-free weekend, this is Salim Fadli for The Pod Delusion.
Now, assuming that the rapture doesn't happen, there's some exciting things happening in the world of hip-hop. No, don't switch off, Grandad. This isn't an uncouth lout spitting rhymes about the prostitutes he's murdered or arrogant boasts about his material wealth. This is about a much more badass subject. Evolution. Baba Brinkman is the rapper behind the rap guide to Evolution, and next week sees the premiere of a series of music videos that he's made about how evolution works. The show is also currently in the process of being turned into an off-Broadway show in New York. If you haven't seen his work before, then do check him out. You won't be disappointed. We've put one of his songs at the very end of this programme. But anyway, Baba was over in London earlier this week, so we met up with his crew in the hood to find out more. Hello, so we're here with the amazing rapper, Baba Brinkman, the creator of the Rap Guide to Evolution, the Rebel Cell, the Rap Guide to the Canterbury Tales. You've done so much, and it's all so very good.
Well, thank you. It's been the Edinburgh Fringe Festival that's kept me on my toes, really.
For all our listeners who are perhaps unfamiliar with you, what is the Rap Guide to Evolution?
The Rap Guide to Evolution is a full-length record and a fringe show that I wrote for the 2009 bicentennial for Charles Darwin. And the way it came together is I was performing the Canterbury Tales raps around England, and I was contacted by a geneticist from Birmingham, Dr. Mark Palin, who was in the process of organizing a Darwin Day celebration for February 12th, and he had money from the British Council to commission some kind of entertainment. To his credit, he could have picked any kind of entertainment. He could have picked a string quartet, but he just really liked rap. And he reached out to me and said, do you think you could do The Origin of Species in rap, since he did the Canterbury Tales? And I just thought that was such a great challenge that I couldn't say no. So we worked together on what the content should be like, and he did fact check the lyrics. And then once I had that for Darwin's birthday, then I brought it to the Fringe. I won an award on the Fringe, a Fringe First Award for Best New Theater Writing, which basically put the big seal of approval on it. And then, more recently, it was optioned by a New York producer, and it will be starting off-Broadway on the 17th of June in a 200-seat theater doing 8 shows a week in Manhattan.
Have you had to modify it at all for American audiences or anything? Or?
Certainly haven't had to tone it down, but we have sort of had to modify it in terms of working with a director and producer and lighting designer to make it more theatrical. So, there's never been a we shouldn't say this because people are too conservative, but there has been a, the dramatic structure of doing this piece after that piece leaves a little dead spot here, so that's all the fine-tuning that we're doing right now.
So the reason you're back in Britain this week is because of the DVD launch of The Rap Guide to Evolution. How did the DVD come about?
Okay, well, to slightly modify, we're not going to have the DVD 100% finished by the 25th, so we're calling it the website launch. Mm. And some of the videos will be up on the website. The DVD will be finished by the end of July, basically. That needs to be ready for the school semester to start in September. Mm. But they'll be the same entity, really, just, part of it's almost done and part of it's not. But what it is a series of music videos funded by the Wellcome Trust, and the Wellcome Trust has a grant called the People's Grant, which is for promoting the public understanding of science. And I think I'm officially the first rap artist to get a grant from the Wellcome Trust. They funded a third of the Human Genome Project, but it took them a while to get around to the hip-hop format. So the great thing about them is that they're going to have a lot of the information content in them, so it's sort of like a cross between an Eminem music video and a David Attenborough nature documentary cutting back and forth. And also there's this great function we came up with called annotated lyrics. So as you watch the video, the lyrics scroll and they have hot links in them to Wikipedia, to peer-reviewed journals, to photos, to little fun facts and things like that. So you get a whole tour of the theory by listening to the video, watching the video, and following the links.
Did it take much convincing, by the way, to convince the Wellcome Trust to fund a rap guide to evolution?
Was there like three beardy old men in the room you had to explain rap? Or?
The Wellcome Trust was a coy mistress, indeed. We had to go on a couple of dates. We applied twice. The first time it wasn't accepted, and the second time it was. And partially that's because we adjusted our target. The first time we were asking for funding to put together the show that was going to go to the Fringe, and it was development money to put on a Fringe show, and they weren't convinced about the potential impact of that. And then we said, okay, now we've got this Fringe show that won a big award. We'd like to turn it into music videos specifically for the YouTube generation, and they were like, now that's the kind of thing that we can get behind.
Do you think Darwin would have approved of rap?
He might have been too shy to approve of rap. I doubt I could see him participating or going to a hip-hop show, but I think he would have approved of the specific application that I'm using rap for, which is to spread his message. And, I took my inspiration from The Origin of Species, and Darwin says, whoever is led to believe that species are mutable would do good service by conscientiously expressing his conviction, for only thus will the load of prejudice by which this subject is overwhelmed to be removed. And I read that and I was like, yeah, that's exactly what people need to do. They need to decide if they believe in it, and if they do, they need to come as hard as they can with expressing that conviction. And so I thought, what better way can you express your conviction than rap? That's what rap's all about. This is the way it is.
So the premiere of for the website and the videos is going to be at the Prince Charles Theatre. Can members of the public come to this?
Oh yeah, absolutely. This is a premiere event. I won't get to do one for when the video finishes because I'll be in New York all summer. So this is the official launch of the project, even if there's not a physical DVD. Absolutely, it's open to the public. I think it's a £10 entry fee, and you will get to see the sort of half of the videos that are done, and the other half that are not done, I'm going to perform as live hip-hop comedy sets. So it's basically like you'll see the whole Rap Guide to Evolution show. Instead of me rapping the whole thing, it'll be back and forth between music video and live rap. So it's a new format.
You mentioned before we were recording, you're redoing some of the songs coming out with a new CD as well.
Yeah, when I first did the Rap Guide to Evolution, the album, it was trying to get it finished in time for the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And, the Edinburgh Fringe, it's a juggernaut. You can't mess around with it. So there's a hard deadline to get it done. And there were some things about the record that I felt like I sort of, stylistically, I could have worked the song better. And I just was like, okay, there's no time, so I'm going to go with this version. So I've then now taken the whole spring to create new beats basically for each of the tracks and add new tracks, because I really want to be best foot forward when I go to New York. I want the version of the CD that I'm selling when I start doing 200 seats at 8 shows a week to the New York public to be the a CD I'm really happy with. So it's great. It's been a chance to rework some of the lyrics, work with some artists collaboratively, I got a new piece that I actually wrote last night, and it's written to go with Helen Arney's song, Animals. Oh, wow. Are you familiar with that song?
Yes, we in fact featured it on our... We're hosting the Uncaged Monkeys Tour podcast, and we featured her song on
there. Okay, so we're doing a remix version for the Rap Guide Devolution with some raps based on Olivia Judson's book, Dr. Tatiana's Sex Advice for All Creation, and it's about the evolutionary biology of sex. You guys ready for a little demo?
Go for it. Yes, please.
Is this the time? Okay, so this will be the first people ever to hear these lyrics, because I literally stayed up all night last night writing them and recording them, and now they will be debuted. Younger listeners should probably cover their ears. All right. Some people say my obsession with biodiversity is a sign of perversity, but I find that it nurtures me. Maybe it's twisted, but I won't give a lady a minute unless she's a Batesian mimic. Does that make me a cynic? I'm into animal roleplay, but fuck a barnyard. I want some praying mantis, open mandible, cannibal foreplay. So read Dr. Tatiana if you need the basics. She's deeper than the fuzzies you find creeping on Craigslist. Plus, she's got a message board full of insectivores who are just itching for it. She's like a sex thesaurus. I met a crab spider who was keen on finding a mate. Her turn-ons included binding and trying to escape. I met a gold digger who told me that fame was her weakness, so I paid her like a cockroach with anal secretions. Yeah, I'm nasty as I want to be, jerking off in front of females like juvenile marine iguanas on the beach, because I'm packing an 8-inch corkscrew. I'm a great fuck. I want to spin it in like an Argentinian lake duck. Yeah, when natural selection reckons your sex practice, the best action is always found in the mismatches. This one girl, she was quite freakish. I wasn't squeamish, but we simply couldn't fit it in. We tried to squeeze it, but she had a 6-inch long clitoris like a hyena's, and I had a spiky inflatable damselfly penis. Ah, Jesus, I'll skip the spider's kiss of death. Just give me 10 consecutive weeks of sex like stick insects. I make solid sperm plugs to try to block girls, but I hate when they pull it out and eat it like fox squirrels. Those are precious resources. I'm really concerned. Humans only bust 180 million sperm, so we start to get depleted after the third shag. Octopus have 10 billion in a massive sperm bag, and when they die, they deposit. That's one way nature might try to persuade a guy to stay monogamous. We must have missed something compared to our chimp cousins, because those chicks will hit a dozen different studs and just love it. So I feel like I'm overdressed for bonobo sex. All I need is a swollen vulva and a vocal yes. No? Okay. Instead, I'll marry my soulmate till death do us part, right? The prairie vole way.
That was amazing. I don't think we can talk. I think we should leave the interview there. Baba Brinkman.
All right.
Thank you very much. We'll put links to everything on the PodSolution website. Have you got anything I should like, actually quickly, have you got anything that you'd like to plug? Because we want to make some money.
If you know teachers who are teaching evolution, check out the rapguide to evolution.co.uk. The videos will be up soon. And all my projects are on my website, so that's the best way to do it. New York Off Broadway, Welcome Trust videos, new CD coming out soon, and, Evolution FTW.
Fantastic. Baba Brinkman, thank you very much.
You can find links to buy tickets for the premiere on Wednesday the 25th on the PodSolution website. It turns out that in Australia, when they're not tying kangaroos down, being good neighbours in an attempt to later become good friends, or indeed locking up migrants on ships, they spend some of their time letting religious people into schools to try and convert their kids to Christianity. Now here's a report by Robert Williams on how one organisation are allegedly bending the rules in order to proselytise in schools. Presumably they start by saying, "Have you heard the good news, mate?"
Australia is seen by many as a very laid-back, liberally minded country, a nation of people who rebel against authority. But this is not the complete story. It has, for example, given the world Ken Ham, famously of Answers in Genesis, a young Earth creationist. And it has also had a swing to the religious right in the last decade or so. In the late 2006, the then Prime Minister John Howard announced a religious school chaplaincy program. This was seen as many as divisive, and a solution to a problem that doesn't actually exist. The government had a slight problem, that paying someone for their religious beliefs was against the Constitution. So what could they do? To ensure the program remains constitutional, chaplains are expressly forbidden from evangelizing or promoting any particular set of beliefs. No conversions. They only provide advice on morals, values, relationships, bereavements, and other topics that religion has no position on. This doesn't stop them from after-school meetings or weekend camps, where they are free to say what they want and to make converts. So we have the strange position of having chaplains, who must be religious, but who are not counsellors, they are not youth workers, they are also not trained professionals. they are also mostly supplied by evangelical groups. It's all rather puzzling. In the state of Victoria, the schools also have a weekly class of special religious instruction. Many people think this is learning about religion, when it is actually just another venue for evangelical Christians to evangelize to children who are too young to realize what they are hearing is not actually true. In Victoria, this is provided by Access Ministries. It's an umbrella group of 12 Christian denominations. In the last week, a speech was found on their website, a speech given by CEO Yvonne Patterson to a conference of bishops in Melbourne. In the speech, she basically says, "In Australia, we have a God-given open door to children and young people with the gospel. Our federal and state governments allow us to take the Christian faith into our schools and share it. We need to go and make disciples. As we develop this perspective in our encounter with students, who will tap into their longing for belonging and acceptance that has grown out of their experience with the worlds of divorce and division." Later on, she says, "An extraordinary opportunity to reach kids with the good news about Jesus. Under God, many come to faith. Some find their way to church. What really matters is seizing the God-given opportunity we have to reach kids in schools. Without Jesus, our students are lost." The website at Fairness and Religion in Schools has a record of Yvonne's interview with Open House Christian Radio. The site has taken the 2008 recording and spliced it with the Open House one. Immediately you can hear how the story she tells the bishops is completely different to the one she gives out on radio. She actually says on the radio, chaplains are forbidden to make converts, at a complete contrast to what she tells the bishops. Access's chairman, Steve Hale, has said that Patterson has been misunderstood. Hale said, "We're not actually seeking to convert them. She may have given that impression, but I don't think that's actually what we do in reality." To back his claim up, Hale asserts that if Access was proselytizing in schools, teachers would be complaining about it. Well, I have looked at the Access Ministries website, and I have found the complaints page, but there's actually nothing on there. So there's no forms, no email addresses, no complaints procedures for Access. The Victorian branch of the Australian Education Union has called for all monies going to Access Ministries to be withdrawn, citing Access volunteers who taught their young charges gems like "Buddha is Satan's friend." The union has said that Patterson's comments were an affront to students in our secular government schools and a clear breach of the federal guidelines for the National School Chaplaincy Program. Professor Gary Booner, an Anglican priest and the UNESCO chairman of Interreligious and Intercultural Relations, has denounced this Access curriculum for special religious indoctrination as crap. And parents have had enough. Ron Williams has started a publicly funded challenge in the High Court to stop the federal government paying money for the chaplaincy program. He hopes to prove that this is a blatant disregard of the Constitution. Parents have also started a website called Fairness in Religions in Schools. It's collecting previously ignored complaints from parents about the activities of Access Ministries. In fact, Access has been backpedaling for the last few days. They've also deleted their Facebook page, been deleting items from the website, and going into damage control. It's quite bizarre. The federal government has had little to say in the matter, except that they will do an investigation. But it's the federal government that's been funding the program for many years, and have actually increased chaplains programming in this year's budget, when they have actually been cutting funds for disabled students. The last three Australian Prime Ministers have been behind this program all the way. Prime Minister Gillard seems to have rediscovered herself as a Baptist. Prime Minister Kevin Rudd would fall to his knees at the slightest provocation. And the originator of the chaplains program was a lifelong Methodist. He seems to have learned a lot of lessons from his fellow Methodist, George W. Bush, on the ways of the religious right. In 2006, in a radio interview, John Howard said, "Yes, I am calling them chaplains because that has a particular connotation in our language. And as you know, I am not overwhelmed by political correctness. To call a chaplain a counsellor is to bow to political correctness. Chaplain has a certain connotation. People understand it, and they know exactly what I am talking about." Interesting, though, only about 7% of the Australian public go to church. But there have been stories that as much as 50% of the federal politicians are part of a crossbench prayer group. So there we go. Has the Australian government really decided to put evangelical missionaries in our schools? It certainly does seem to point this way. But then again, I may just be having a case of conspiracy overload. How can we fix this? Firstly, we need to stop funding the chaplains. and get real youth workers in schools, and we need to stop these divisive religious classes. Buranda State School in Queensland has been successfully teaching philosophy classes for over 10 years. I suggest this would be an excellent model for the rest of the country. A class that is not about being obedient, such as religion teaches you, but this one is about thinking. Fancy that. Learning about thinking in schools. If this was rolled out to students across Australia, then we would have a start on an education system that we could be proud of, rather than one which is a humiliation. If you cared about children, you would pay for professional youth workers. If you cared about votes, you will pay for chaplains. This is Robert Williams for the Podillusion.
Now, our next report is about the conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Now, obviously, this is a deeply complex political issue that has stretched back decades, if not arguably centuries, and it touches upon many contentious issues of identity, race, religion, war, and justice, and it's a topic where understanding the nuance is crucial to being able to adequately analyse and articulate an opinion on the situation there. Though, to cut a long story short, basically both sides are being twats about it. But this hasn't stopped Mark Thomas from wading in, almost literally. He's written a new book and stand-up show about his walk along the route of the wall that the Israelis have constructed to encircle the West Bank. And James Thomas has been speaking to him, presumably to find out how he avoided getting shot by at least one side.
This is James Thomas for the Podillusion, and I'm here at the Tricycle Theatre in Kilburn, and I'm delighted to be talking to Mark Thomas. Mark, could you please give our listeners a flavour of what extreme rambling is like to experience, and why you feel it's important that they should read about your time in the West Bank in Israel?
I basically walked from the... used the Israeli barrier on the West Bank as the route of a walk, and it virtually encircles the West Bank. It's going to be 723 kilometres long when it's finished, and I started at one end and got to the other and walked on both sides, talking to Palestinians, Israelis, getting into scrapes, mucking about, eating too much hummus, that kind of stuff. And for me, it was just a really incredibly exciting thing to do. I've never done anything. I mean, I've done some really nuts, stupid things, do you know what I mean? Of all of that kind of stuff, this is probably the most unusual, which is kind of one of the reasons that I liked it. A lot of people would ask me, why is that? Just, the reaction would happen to say, I'm walking a length of the barrier, and people would go, wow, that's brilliant, why are you doing it? And I'd go, well, I don't rightly know, I think it's interesting. Part of it is subversion, you know, the idea of using it, you know, the very idea of using a trail that will become a trail, that using a wall that will actually become a tourist trail at some point, like Hadrian's Wall or the Great Wall of China or something like that. Using a serving an active military wall as a Jewish trail is a little bit of an act of subversion. And also, it's a great way of finding out about a conflict involving sort of identity and land is to walk and talk. So that's a really interesting way of doing it. But I found it a really exciting thing to do.
Common theme in your work is recording normal reaction to the utter absurdity of the situation that you find you and your friends in. And I was wondering if you could tell us how close you came to just losing it. And I'm thinking specifically about Indonesian major generals flapping their arms and inflating plastic toys and Israeli soldiers trying to claim that their shoes are of strategic importance to Hezbollah.
Yeah, and that was kind of... those moments were kind of just full of surrealism. There's one moment when we were walking... it's a place called Anata, which is in East Jerusalem, just on the edge of it. On the map, the town of Anata is on the Palestinian side of the barrier. But there's a line on the map that goes through Anata. And this line is the municipal boundary. So a little bit of Anata, that is a Palestinian village on the Palestinian side of the wall, is technically in Jerusalem. And I met a bloke called Oday who explained how the line goes down an alleyway and cuts his house in two. And I said, well, where does the line go? It goes through my stairwell. I said, well, so your stairwell's in Israel? He said, no, part of it is in Jerusalem, part of it is in the West Bank. I said, okay. He said, I said, where does it go? He said, then it cuts my dining room, it goes through my dining room, round my living room, and cuts my balcony in half. I started laughing, going, wow, you've got a house in two states. And he said it was about 2 o'clock in the morning when the Israeli army came and arrested everyone in the building for illegally entering Israel, for walking into the living room. The absurdity of it makes you laugh. And yet the absolute horror of it is incredible. You know, to have every single inhabitant, from babies through to grandparents, arrested 150 people. And it's like those sorts of stories are just everywhere. Everywhere. And so the absurdism of it is just, you know, utterly amazing. And there are bits where it becomes, sometimes it becomes like you're just doing a job, actually, because you just want to get the story. And you want to cover it from all angles, and you want to make sure that everything's right, and you've got the shots and all of this. Because it will be the fourth time you've encountered madness that day. Sometimes the way, it's just actually the physical task of getting from A to B is what dominates it. And actually that, trying to get everything in, just trying to record everything and make sure you've noted everything and talked to the people and followed up all the questions. It's just, there is a funny way in which you don't, that actually processes the thing and processes your reaction and sometimes rage to the situation.
A bit like a photojournalist, you've just got to...
Yeah, otherwise you'd just be in tears every single day. Yeah. And there are days when you were, you know, just sort of like... But there are also days when it's just delightful and it's wonderful and it's exciting and beautiful and, you know, your kids following us, you know, picking tangerines and all of that from trees and giving them to us as we walk along, or when Faddy actually kind of goes around picking wild asparagus for us, you know, and it's absolutely beautiful. There are days when it's absolutely, and actually you can have them on the same day. I remember walking with Mustafa one day and we were just merrily picking mushrooms. It was just great. It was really beautiful, picking mushrooms, loads and loads of mushrooms, and I accidentally picked up this massive live ammunition round because it looked kind of like a mushroom in the mud. And you know, you go from one situation from the next like that. So it's an intense experience.
A hugely telling moment is when you try and discuss the beauty of West Bank with Michael from Breaking the Silence.
Yes,
he just cannot allow himself to enjoy the West Bank with you. Mm. And it seems to sum up the deliberate conflict in the book between travelogue and documentary, because it is, despite everything else, it is a walking book. It's a rambling book.
Yeah. But also in the chapters before that, there's just a little bit about how I'm walking with Eunice, and I try and get him to see how beautiful it is, and he says, I can't see it because it could be gone tomorrow. And actually it's about those, how you see things. You can see the same thing and it will mean different things to different people.
One of the joys of reading your work is that in the best traditions of reportage, you never lose empathy for either side of the argument. I genuinely hope so.
I think that there are, that the ideologues and the settlers and the religious nuts who are pushing forward the settlement programme, I would love for them to actually just really have empathy and see what they're asking Israel's children to do. I want them to try and understand that what they are doing, there is a reason those boys go out to Thailand and Gara and get stoned for a year after serving in the army. And it is not because they've had a great time. Look, I'm never going to be impartial. No one can be impartial. But in the same way, you'd be an idiot if you went without preconceptions, and you'd be a damn fool if they weren't changed as you walked along. I was fascinated by that. I loved the Israeli activists. I absolutely adored them. And it's very funny because that was the thing that shocked me above all else, other than the fact that the wall and the occupation really is much worse than I'd imagined. The thing that shocked me about that was just this daily humiliation and degradation, you know, of a soldier's arbitrary decision that could affect someone's life. Just absolutely amazing. And I think that's, you know, that really shocked me. But secondly, what really surprised me was that moral core that the Israeli activists have. They're not big in numbers. There is almost a feeling of McCarthyism there at times. To stand up and say, no, this is wrong, is quite an important and quite an amazing thing to do.
And this is because Podlusion is a bit of a, supposedly a humorous podcast, I have to ask. Your best anti-chafing advice.
And best anti-chafing advice is medical talcum powder. And so each morning was just like this eruption of talc. Every morning it was kind of, I was terrified that was going to stop us. I thought, if I get a corn, do you know what I mean? I can't walk. I'll just be so annoyed. If I get blisters, you know, I'll be so pissed off. And so we were double socking, medicated talcum powder. You know, everything was carried around with us. The other thing is, you can actually get walking pants, walking underwear. I don't think I really mentioned this in the book, but you can get walking underwear. And I remember taking it home, and it looks like sort of like, it's quite tight, and it comes down to just above the knee, and it's like a loose lycra. And my wife just looked at it and just went, are you auditioning for Steptoe, son? I said, these are walking pants. It's just like, oh, mate, if you need walking pants, you're in trouble.
Mark Thomas, I cannot believe how much that fun that was. Thank you very much.
That's a real pleasure. Thank you for coming on, man.
Now, is your enemy's enemy your friend? Churchill thought so, and that turned out all right. Hitler thought so, and the same bloke actually betrayed him, so be careful. Which is perhaps good advice for Drew Ray, who's been having similar thoughts. Not about aligning himself with Stalin, I don't want to libel him with that, but about whether moderate Christians should work with atheists and secularists to achieve common goals. Here's Drew, who's definitely not got anything to do with Stalin, with more.
On his website last Saturday, Richard Dawkins asked the question, quote, given that Islam is such an unmitigated evil, should we be supporting Christian missions in Africa? My answer is still no, but I thought it was worth raising the question. Given that atheism hasn't any chance in Africa for the foreseeable future, could our enemy's enemy be our friend? End quote. The question is consistent with Dawkins' previously expressed opinions that he considers Islam particularly to be one of the great evils of the world. This opinion of Dawkins, I believe to be a blatant category error. Good and evil are not properties that can be meaningfully assigned to labels that encompass broad spectrums of ideas, beliefs, and practices. Even at the level of single individuals, you could not empirically determine whether people would be more or less moral if you could surgically add or remove religious belief. Religion and its absence are emergent characteristics of a lifetime of experience. The question of alliances between skeptics and believers is an interesting one, though. In the case of Africa, I would side with Dawkins' no camp, but for different reasons. One of the ways belief causes so much harm in developing nations is that it is frequently pre-Enlightenment ideas that are openly hostile to evidence and warrant. And that's true of almost all flavours of religion growing across most of Africa. Supporting pre-Enlightenment Christian fundamentalism against pre-Enlightenment Islamic fundamentalism is a losing proposition. Even being on the winning side would still be a strategic loss. I would like to propose a more fertile ground for Christian and skeptic alliance: urban Britain. The values that are held by the skeptic movement are good for all society, and we are doing ourselves a disservice if we exclude from our ranks some of the largest and best organised groups of volunteers motivated to improve society. We know that religion has no monopoly on morality. Arguably, there's not even a correlation between religiosity and morality. On the other hand, when it comes to organised collective projects in pursuit of moral ends, the skeptic movement are amateurs compared to the established church. We wouldn't be approaching cap in hand either. If you went looking for the world's foremost experts in building communities using podcasts, Twitter, social networking, and YouTube, well, actually, if you did that, you'd probably find a bunch of World of Warcraft tribes and guilds. But if you added to your requirements expertise in grassroots, face-to-face gatherings, and in street activism, the skeptics take the prize. Pick a church, any church, and ask them for their wish list of skills necessary for maintaining their relevance into the future. About the only box we as skeptics don't tick is good music, and even that one we're working on. Shout-outs here to Roy Zimmerman and Tim Minchin. Now, I know not everyone agrees with me that tolerance of religion in any form is a good thing. Hear me out, though. As Massimo Pellucci of the Rationally Speaking podcast is fond of saying, truth springs from arguments between friends. If you enter an argument hoping to convince the other side, you will fail. If you aim instead to refine your own ideas and to learn from your opponent, then you will achieve something. If you genuinely believe that atheism is an inevitable consequence of critical thinking, then make skeptics out of the theists and wait for the inevitable deconversion or head explosion. Don't preach atheism, teach critical thinking and observe the consequences. If you believe, on the other hand, that faith and critical thinking are genuinely compatible, then come break bread with a community that's both spiritually barren and proud of the fact. It's your duty to do so. This isn't just a pod delusion rant, by the way. It's a genuine invitation to both communities. I'm talking here about the concept of a church-affiliated skeptics in the pub. No obligation for theists or atheists to check their beliefs at the door, just a willingness to embrace self-examination, reason, and evidence. Richard Dawkins is welcome to come and communicate about science. Next month, we'll have an imam discuss strategies for reversing the brain drain of Middle East scholars to Western universities, but they can both leave intolerance at home. This is Drew Ray for the Pod Delusion.
If you're up in Newcastle, Drew will be speaking to the Newcastle Skeptics on Wednesday the 25th of May at 7 p.m. He'll be giving a talk called Dealing Reasonably with a Rational Fear. You can find links and more information on this on the Pod Delusion website. This week saw the publication of the Hargreaves Review into copyright. If you're a regular listener to the programme, then you'll know that we've covered the Digital Economy Act in some depth. If you're a new listener, basically, rubbish. The Hargreaves Review, though, is interesting as it proposes some seemingly sensible reforms to copyright law, such as making ripping a CD to put it on your iPod actually legal. Salim Fadley has been speaking to copyright expert Emily Goodhand, who you may know as Copyright Girl, to find out if this is in fact good news.
When we last told the story of the Digital Economy Act, it had just been passed by some quite extraordinary House of Commons chicanery. Since the outgoing Labour government had rushed the Digital Economy Act through the Commons, what has changed?
Well, the Hargreaves recommendations, for a start, which were published today, have been very interesting to kind of see. The Digital Economy Act in itself is sort of gone through the courts. It's been subject to judicial review. It's then been on hold. We're still waiting for an Ofcom code of practice that hasn't come yet. So we're still waiting to see kind of the implementation of the Digital Economy Act, and it doesn't look like it's going anywhere soon. The Hargreaves review of IP, which Cameron called for back in November, has actually mentioned the Digital Economy Act in the body of its text and its recommendations as part of the enforcement practices for rights holders to enforce copyright. So that's where we're up to now with the Digital Economy Act.
I get the impression that unlike the Digital Economy Act, the Hargreaves report is mostly a step in the right direction, but it's missing quite a few provisions that might make it the perfect proposal. Is that a fair summary, or have I fallen for the spin?
I think it's fair to say that the Hargreaves report is fair. I think it's been very much welcomed by the consumers and by some of the creative industries and education and cultural sector. It's allowed for a balanced view, whereas unlike the Digital Economy Act, which focused very much on kind of the lobbyists and the rights holders' wishes, the Hargreaves report has tipped the balance back in favour of the users and the consumers. The difficulty is that the recommendations, they are just recommendations, and we have to wait and see now what the government wants to do and how they implement them. That's going to be the key factor in this.
One of the most controversial issues that the Hargreaves report directly addresses is that of orphan works. These are usually recorded works for whom nobody knows the rights owner. So is this proposal likely to provide an acceptable solution to this seemingly eternal problem?
I think it has a decent stab at it, to be honest. Orphan works is a real issue, particularly for the cultural sector, who just have thousands and thousands of works in their archives, lying dormant. Currently, there's no format shifting for preservation, which is also a problem, particularly for things like film and photographs. Orphan works, like you said, it's very difficult to trace the rights holder. You can try and trace the rights holder, but people can try for years and years and years and actually reach a dead end and not get anywhere. So it becomes a real problem. But it's very much a battle of two worlds, really, because you've got, on the one hand, the cultural sector with all of this orphan works in their sort of basements, archives, whatever. And on the other hand, you've got the creative sector, who are very much keen to not see orphan works being exploited, particularly for commercial gain, without sort of the permission of the rights holder.
But we have a bizarre situation right now where even museums aren't able to make digital copies of, say, classic jazz recordings for fear of violating the copyright law as it currently stands.
That's correct. It's something that's needed looking at for a long, long time. And, you know, the cultural sector were hoping that the Gowers Review would have done something for it. The Gowers Review addressed it. They nearly came close to having a statutory instrument to implement it. And then there was an election and then everything went very quiet. So we've been waiting for a long time. And I do think that the Hargreaves recommendations will allow for the format shifting for preservation purposes. And I think it's so, so important because so much cultural heritage that's just crumbling into dust, and it's a tragedy.
There was a legitimate argument on the other side, particularly from photographers, who were concerned that a very open license to use orphan works would result in a sort of free-for-all in which big publishers were free to rip off their photos and simply give the excuse that they were unable to find the original producer. So do you think we've actually found a real compromise which will address these legitimate sounding concerns?
I think it's a possibility. It's certainly a good start. I am aware that there's a lot of scepticism from particularly the photographic sector about orphan works. You know, there's certain things that they definitely don't want to see in terms of orphan works. They're very, very cynical of the big industries, not only using orphan works and exploiting them commercially without the permission of the rights holders, but also it challenges their business models, it threatens their livelihoods, and so they're quite concerned about all of this. Something that they don't want to see is the reintroduction of Clause 43 from the Digital Economy Bill, which you may remember they successfully lobbied out of the bill before it went through Parliament. The provisions in the Hargreaves Review kind of make mention of the extended collective licensing, which they didn't like in the first place. So, you know, there's a lot of real concern from the photographic sector that this is just going to be another Digital Economy Bill Clause 43 situation.
This copyright reform proposal aims to address some very real problems in copyright law today, such as the inability to shift media legally. This is, for example, the ability to rip audio to an MP3 player. Technically, this is actually illegal right now, isn't it?
It is, and it's something that surprised a lot of people and has been very much splattered all over the press today, which is very interesting for me to see, because I've known this for a while, and it always surprises people when I teach them about copyright that actually, you know, just the simple act of putting a CD in your computer and then having iTunes import the data and then for you to put it onto, say, your iPod or, you know, other device, that is actually a copyright infringement, really. Not a criminal infringement, I have to specify, because it is private use. It's a civil infringement. So yes, technically it is an infringement, so it's technically unlawful.
So Hargreaves has proposed that this should now be legal. It will now be possible to transcode video from, say, one media and convert it to another.
Yes, I mean, obviously the fact that it's unlawful doesn't mean to say that it's not happening already, because obviously this is something that everybody does, just because generally nobody really knew until perhaps today that it was actually an unlawful act. But yes, Hargreaves has made the recommendation that format shifting should be allowable for private use and sort of, you know, within kind of immediate family, so sort of lending music to your brother or your father or whatever, that would be allowed.
There's also some other good news, that there's a proposal to amend the law to protect people who have made parodies. For example, songs which reuse a melody to poke fun at the original artist. At the moment, British law has no concept remotely resembling fair use, which would make such a parody song a form of protected speech. So could this bring in something a little bit like fair use?
perhaps a little bit like it. I have to be very careful here because fair use is very much an American copyright law concept and fair dealing is very much a UK concept. And fair dealing is a lot narrower than fair use and doesn't invite as much litigation. But yes, in terms of parody, there's an exception for that in the EU Information Society Directive. Hargreaves has actually proposed that we implement all of the Article 5 exceptions, which I wholeheartedly would agree with because there's no reason why we shouldn't have done. In the first place, when we harmonised copyright law with Europe in 2003. So yes, there would be an exception for parody, pastiche and caricature, which I think would be fantastic because I've always found it very ironic that as a country who enjoys a good ironic sense of humour, a good sarcasm, we don't actually have any copyright exception for parody.
Finally, the text of the Digital Economy Act emphasised a desire to punish people who use peer-to-peer download services, possibly implementing a French-style three strikes and you're outlaw. Is there anything that might moderate some of the more draconian cut-off-his-internet proposals of the Digital Economy Act?
I mean, one thing that Hargreaves has mentioned in his report is, yes, the Digital Economy Act, the essential kind of enforcement style of the Digital Economy Act will prevail and Ofcom will issue a code of practice to ISPs. However, this needs to be reviewed in light of what's going on, so it will need to be monitored. I'm hoping that they don't go down the route of cutting off the internet. Apart from anything else, I do think it's an infringement of human rights. So I do think that Europe would have something to say about that, as it already has done. But I do think that it will be something that will be reviewed and reviewed and monitored. There will be enforcement steps, there will be measures in place, but I hope that it won't be as draconian as cutting off the internet, because that would just be ridiculous. But don't forget that these are just recommendations at the moment. We have yet to see what the government decides to do, whether they decide to accept them, whether they decide to ignore them, whether they pick and choose, and then how they implement them as well. So watch this space.
So do they actually practice Chinese medicine in China, or do they know it's bollocks? I assumed it was basically all an act for tourists. It's a bit like how no one in London actually talks like Dick Van Dyke in Mary Poppins, and that you're more likely to see a fried chicken shop than a fish and chip shop. It turns out, though, that there's still some people who are really into us over there. So get those candles out of your ears and listen to Cash Farouk, who's been over in China, to find out more.
I recently had my first experience of a cruise, a three-day cruise on the River Yangtze. There were only a handful of English speakers on the cruise, so after embarkation, see, I know the lingo already, we were given a guided tour of the ship instead of having to sit through an introductory presentation. Straight away, we bumped into the ship's doctor, Dr. George. Good, I thought, you need a doctor on a ship. I've heard about all those nasty vomiting bugs that you get on cruises. Dr. George informed us that he was there to help with any new or existing conditions and hoped we would be able to attend his lecture the following morning, a lecture about traditional Chinese medicine. Turns out that Dr. George studied at a TCM college. Whilst being glared at by my wife with that "don't you dare say a word" expression on her face, I knew that, being a good sceptic, of course I had to attend and take notes. So I did, and it was very enlightening. The first point that Dr. George wanted to get across was just how old traditional Chinese medicine is. It has been around for 5,000 years, he informed us. If I'm not mistaken, I believe that is the appeal to antiquity logical fallacy. For those of you who don't know, traditional Chinese medicine covers a broad range of practices such as acupuncture, massage and herbal medicine. These disciplines have been around for a long time. The Chinese Communist Party ridiculed these practices as irrational, backwards and based on superstition. Then they had a complete change of mind when they realised, shit, we need healthcare and we can't afford it. Chairman Mao revived it as a cheap way of providing healthcare to the masses, even though he did not use it himself or even believe it worked. It was in fact Mao's government that coined and promoted the term traditional Chinese medicine. The government created an army of barefoot doctors, farmers who received minimal basic medical training and then worked in the rural villages. And now, Dr. George was going to tell us all about these ancient practices. I learned that 40 meridians connect your internal organs to external parts of your body, and that these can be accessed via acupuncture points. He informed the audience that this is why chiropractic works. The chiropractors lucked out by hitting one of the meridians through the back. Perhaps the British Chiropractic Association should have mentioned this during their libel case. It may have helped. All the organs can also be accessed via a person's ear, apparently. They used to perform acupuncture on the ear, but it was too painful. They have now discovered that they can just sellotape herbal seeds to certain points on the ear, and it works just as well as the needles did. Strange that. Call me cynical, but I'm going to speculate that taping cat litter to the ear will work just as well. The doctor then displayed a World Health Organization list of diseases and disorders that can be treated with acupuncture. I was startled that such a list exists. I've since checked, and it does exist on the World Health Organization website, a webpage from 2003 listing all the diseases that Dr. George listed. There was, of course, no mention of the numerous Cochrane reviews suggesting that relief from acupuncture is just due to the placebo effect. I recommend that you read Trick or Treatment by Ernst and Singh for more about that. And now we moved on to the hands. Dr. George can learn a lot about your health just by looking at your hands. A broken lifeline, for example, shows that you have a lung problem. Wavy lines cutting across your lifeline shows what you are allergic to. Next up, on this non-stop alt-med rollercoaster ride, was reflexology. A contrived diagram appeared on the projector screen, showing a drawing of a pair of feet pushed together. "Can you see what that looks like?" Dr. George asked. "It looks like a human torso. The big toes form a head. The heel represents your arse." He may not have used the word arse. "Therefore," Dr. George asserted, "we can access any problems in the head area via your big toes." I was sitting near the back, so he could not see the incredulous expression on my face. Good job too, as his next sentence was, "If during this trip you come to me with a headache or a migraine, I won't examine your head. I will look at your feet." Dr. George looked satisfied with how his presentation had gone. He had explained the science of TCM to his audience, and had convinced everyone that it definitely worked. He didn't seem to notice that the mechanics of reflexology and acupuncture that he had just described contradicted each other. So finally, there was only one thing left to do when presenting to an audience that was 95% European and French-Canadian: attack Western medicine. A lot of his assertions will be familiar to skeptics, arguments included. Western medicine treats the symptoms, not the cause of the symptoms. Chinese medicine has a philosophy of prevention rather than cure. Chinese medicine is all natural, there are no chemicals. Some of his arguments, however, I was not expecting to hear. I thought that these arguments were just the preserve of homeopaths and other alternative medicine peddlers in the West. Dr. George stated that Western medicine requires you to use it forever, that you will never be able to stop using the drugs once you start, that Western medicine's answer to every situation is surgery or pills. And do you know why Western medicine so readily resorts to these solutions? Big Pharma. Yes, he blamed Big Pharma. Yes, that conspiracy theory is alive and well in China too. I'm hoping that, after this report, I'll finally get my damn Big Pharma check that I so richly deserve. China is a very superstitious country. The amount of superstition that I witnessed did surprise me. Everyone seems to believe this stuff. There were reflexology and acupuncture adverts everywhere. Each one of our guides asked us if we need to see a reflexologist for anything. And on a ship that is potentially several hours away from emergency facilities, the onboard doctor was, essentially, a quack. I'm just glad that nobody on the cruise was ill. This is Kash Farouk, now probably banned from Yangtze River Cruises, reporting for the Poddelusion.
And that's it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can hear exclusive podcasts from backstage at the Uncaged Monkeys tour. We've got exclusive audio of Robin Ince, Brian Cox, Simon Singh and Ben Goldacre, and many of their guests throughout the run, answering some of the questions they didn't have time to answer on stage. You can hear all these podcasts, they're known as the Free Primates podcasts, at poddelusion.co.uk. Also on our website, you can listen back to older episodes of the show and find our Poddelusion extra feed, which is full of bonus content we've recorded all over the place, extended interviews, lectures. It's all really good stuff, so do check that out at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Salim Fadley, Robert Williams, James Thomas, Drew Ray, Cash Farouk, Liz Lutgendorf, and me, James O'Malley. With special thanks to Liz for loads of additional editing this week. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Service by conscientiously expressing his conviction. For only thus can the load of prejudice by which this subject is overwhelmed be removed.
So what you know about natural selection? Go ahead and ask a question and see where the answer gets you. Try being passive aggressive or try smashing heads in and see which tactic brings your plans to fruition. If you have an explanation in mind, then you're wasting your time, because the best watchmaker is blind. Takes a certain base kind of impatient mind to explain away nature with intelligent design. But the truth shall set you free from those useless superstitious beliefs in a literal Adam and Eve and that Edenic myth, because their family tree is showing some genetic drift. Take it from this bald-headed non-celibate monk with the lyrical equivalent of an elephant's trunk. It's time to elevate your mind state and celebrate your kinship with the primates. The weak and the strong, who got it going on? We lived in the dark for so long. The weak and the strong, Darwin got it going on. Creationism is dead wrong.
The view which most naturalists entertain, namely that each species has been independently created, is erroneous.
Okay, it's time to reveal my identity. I'm the manifestation of tens of millions of centuries of sexual selection. Best believe I'm the best of the best of the best of the best of generations of competitive pressure genetically. But don't get upset, cause we got the same pedigree. You and I will find a common ancestor eventually if we rewind geological time regressively. And I can say the same for this hibiscus tree and this lizard and this flea and this sesame seed. And if you still disbelieve in what your senses perceive, I could even use this rhyme as a remedy, cause there's so much variation in the styles in this industry and differential survival when the people listening decide what they're into and what really isn't interesting. You could thrive like Timberlake on a Timberland beat, or go extinct like Vanilla Ice and NSYNC. It's survival of the fittest, but fitness is a tricky thing. It changes from place to place, from winter to spring. But the real question in this social scientific simile is heredity, whether we inherit our techniques from our predecessors or invent them independently. But then we're talking memes, and that's a different thing. Richard Dawkins, can I get a proper definition, please? The weak and the strong, who got it going on? Lived in the dark for so long. The weak and the strong, Darwin got it going on. Creationism is dead wrong. The weak and the strong, who got it going on? Whoever leaves the most spawn. The weak and the strong, Darwin got it going on. Creationism is
erroneous.
I hear some people complain, like, I don't want to be an ape. I never came from monkey DNA. I believe God made me in a day. Jesus saves. Yeah, he's great. But stop being afraid to use the reason he gave you to let science solve some giant problems and find some final results. I think it's time for y'all to let your minds evolve and listen to a different kind of silent call. The kind that comes from pine trees and not pine saw. I'm talking about the mystical vision that Einstein saw, wondering at the infinite depths of divine thought and realizing that scripture could never define God. Because if there is a personal God, then he's been jerking. So why would he bother designing an albatross when natural selection already does such an excellent job just by balancing benefits and costs? I say banish God into the gaps if he can't help us understand the simplest facts. I want a relaxed God of infinite naps. We'll be alright without him. Just give us a chance. The weak and the strong, who got it going on? We lived in the dark for so long. The weak and the strong, Darwin got it going on. Creationism is dead wrong. The weak and the strong, who got it going on? Whoever leaves the most spawn. The weak and the strong, Darwin got it going on. Creationism is dead wrong. Dead wrong. See, everybody's always talking about, do you believe in evolution? Do you believe in creation? Nobody believes in evolution. You either understand evolution or you don't. It's nothing to believe. Something to perceive, feel, experience. Do you believe in gravity? Come on. You can see it with your own eyes. Just gotta look. look deeper.